Okay, what's the biggest threat to humanity and the planet right now? Well, listening to everyone across the whole spectrum from left to right, I mean, even Tony Abbott thinks we should do something. That's why he's got a climate action plan. So across the spectrum, it's quite clear that most think it's human-induced climate change, this total catastrophe rolling towards us. And it's usually coupled with some other specific area of ecological threat that, you know, justifiably concern people. Nuclear power plants, uranium mining, pollution, resource depletion and the like. Well, I actually don't agree. The biggest threat to humanity and the planet on which we live is capitalism. Yes, capitalism in its many manifestations, its destruction of the planet, its resource stripping, its wars, its financial crises, the immiseration of millions, the racism, sexism and homophobia that is ever present. But fundamentally, it is capitalism itself that is the biggest threat. And that is because it is a system that must maintain such inequality and destructiveness to ensure its continued survival. A system whose inner logic drives it to destroy even as it creates. But aren't I just splitting hairs, you know, saying the same thing in different ways? Aren't I denying the truth of the popular slogan, there's no jobs on a dead planet? Surely saving the planet by whatever means available is the key issue facing us today. And again, the answer has to be no. Of course we need to stop environmental destruction. But just like we need to put an end to hunger, disease, wars, oppression. You know, the list goes on. Because if we don't, we're looking at barbarism on the way to a dead planet. So I'm not arguing to abstain from environmental issues. I'm not arguing that making demands on the system to close down polluting industries are completely pointless. It's a no-brainer that having cleaner environment, for example, is better for everyone's health and that of the planet. And, of course, we need to be part of the campaigns for reform within the system because we know it is the fight over and above the reform itself that is the key. But we have to be clear about what our main target is. And our main target is capitalism, which means the demands we make, the goals we aim for, the movements we build have to be focused around the demands that will build the class struggle, that will build the revolutionary organisations, that we are part of building an organised working class able to confront and ultimately defeat capitalism and everything it stands for. And I'll put this argument in a different way. We agree we're facing some hugely damaging ecological crisis. If we then also agree that it is capitalism that has brought us close to the brink of planetary catastrophe, why think that it was within capitalism to resolve such a disaster? After all, no one thinks that winning equal pay will get rid of workers' exploitation. Why work on the assumption, then, that the adoption of renewable energy, public transport rather than cars and the like, while capitalism continues to operate, will save the planet from climate meltdown? Because capitalism could incorporate greener technology. Why they're not doing it now on a scale that could, you know, have an impact is another question entirely. To do with the way that capitalism has developed historically into an oil-dependent economy. But there is no law that says capitalism must have an oil-based economy or that plastics are essential to its survival. Faced with an end to oil, gas or coal resources, capitalism can just as easily live off the profits based on the production and sale of renewable energy, more sustainable production processes and so on. After all, before oil, steam to power engines was the technology of the day. And now there are companies growing rich on renewable energy, organic farming or environmentally sound building practices. And you can see some significant preparations for a low-carbon future in places like China. Now, it's even conceivable that in the face of an immense global crisis brought on by climate change, where social upheaval and instability threatens the survival of key sections of global capitalism, that the ruling class could bring about some dramatic shift to prematurely shut down fossil fuel use and switch to sustainable production. And I'm sure it's one of the scenarios US corporations and government are actively investigating now in the face of the Arab revolutions. However, the fact remains, A transfer from fossil fuels to renewable energy would not challenge the system of capitalism, just as changing from wood and steam to coal and oil did not undermine the role of capital. Sure, it transformed the economy's productive capacity, it gave it a massive boost. And that in itself is a key characteristic of capitalism as it adopts new technology. But the change in technology in no way stopped capitalism in its tracks. It did the exact opposite. In fact, all the pro-environment changes we may manage to bring about could even have the perverse effect of lengthening the rule of capital and drive it further and faster in its destruction of the world. Unless, of course, we overthrow it beforehand. None have described why this is so better than Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. And I may be telling many here what they already know about capitalism. But I think we need to hear this argument again in the context of this debate we're having on climate change solutions. Because confusion over how proposed solutions to climate change fits in with the capitalist system, as with so many other questions that we face today, confusion over that will only lead to capitulation or accommodation to the ruling class agenda. And we only have to look at George Monbiot's recent switch to support nuclear as a sort of glaring example of where that sort of thinking can lead. So when Marx and Engels described capitalism, they pointed to the two main classes who face off each other in this society, a majority working class and a minority ruling class, where the minority extract a surplus from the workers' labour, which they then turn into profit. And it is this drive for profit, regardless of the source of that profit, that powers capitalism. The Ranger uranium mine, where the company, despite the many spills, leaks, accidents, potential catastrophe there, and the opposition of the local Mirarr people, ignores all of this in the face of the potential profits from the estimated $18 billion worth of uranium ore still to be mined. The need for profit and even more profit forces the companies to continually seek out and develop new markets, new resource supplies, new goods or cheaper ways of manufacturing existing goods. It is for good reason that Marx described capitalism as being the most innovative and productive economic process human society has devised to date. But alongside this innovative economy, as Marx and Engels point out, come the wars to capture new resources and markets, the development of monopoly capitalism and imperialism to intensify exploitation and the oppression that keeps capitalism's gravediggers, the working class, divided and weakened. So what we see is an unstoppable, accelerating treadmill of production, where Karl Marx says that is the law driven by competition, which again and again throws bourgeois production out of its old course and, you know, into new ways of doing things, and which compels capital to intensify the productive forces of labour. And because it has intensified them, this law gives capital no rest, continually whispering in its ear, go on, go on. And this will apply as much to a system running on renewable energy or fossil fuels, a system making depleted uranium warheads or processing milk. And I want to repeat here, this doesn't mean we say, let's just keep burning oil and coal, but it does mean that we understand that so long as we have capitalism, it is not the type of energy we use or reducing the use in any one process that will ultimately save the planet. If anything, using renewables could actually prolong the life of capitalism and as a consequence all its destructive powers. Now, although, as Marx indicates, capital has no rest from the pressure to constantly innovate, constantly change, to harvest profit from every source, the promise of future profits from renewable energy, from improving the efficiency of energy use and the like, hasn't always seen the ruling class rush to embrace it. BlueScope Steel, for example, in Australia, has been talking about cutting emissions since 1989. And investing in such technologies as cogeneration, general upgrading to make more efficient use of materials and energy in the production process, tree planting to offset emissions, and using recycled steel. Now, they've all been discussed and absolutely nothing has happened. So, will the Gillard government's proposed carbon tax, the measure claimed by the Greens as one of their finest achievements, will this tax push capital, no matter how unwilling, into the arms of renewable energy and bring about reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, and who will actually pay the cost? Carbon tax is a form of pollution tax, one of a variety of ways of putting on what's known as a price on carbon. And this is the way the debate sometimes gets fudged. You know, you talk about price on carbon. So, and there are other ways that you can do that. But basically it means it levies a fee on the production, distribution or use of fossil fuels. So it's at every stage of the process, based on how, or at any one stage of the process, based on how much carbon their combustion emits. The government sets a price per tonne on carbon, then translates it into a tax on electricity, natural gas or oil. And because the tax is meant to make using dirty fuels more expensive, it should encourage utilities, businesses and individuals to reduce consumption and increase energy efficiency. As I said, the tax can be levied at any of those different points of production and consumption. So any one of these points, the tax should then encourage the companies and individuals to seek alternatives. The alternatives hopefully will become cheaper and more competitive with the old fossil fuels. And it is also intended to drive social change in the way we live our lives, you know, public transport rather than cars, the way our cities and buildings are designed and so on. The revenue raised from the taxes, apart from compensating some businesses and consumers for the higher costs that are inevitable in this transition, is then funneled by government into developing renewable energy sources, infrastructure and the like. And proponents of a carbon tax argue that the price on fossil fuels should include the societal costs of carbon pollution. You know, in other words, if you're polluting to everyone else's detriment, you should have to pay for it. And that is how it is meant to work. Pay a tax for the pollution, use the collective monies to invest in green technology, people and companies will have an incentive to change the way they do things, reduce use and so on, and we have a seamless change from fossil fuels to renewables and an equitable funding of this transition. But the ruling class has a different agenda. Why? Well, you know, actually on the whole, they all say they're 100% behind putting a price on carbon. Not one of them is prepared to pay for it. Whether they run the companies digging up the coal to the food manufacturing concerns who will have to cover the costs of converting their factories to more efficient energy use and et cetera, they're all of one voice, no. Instead, they want total compensation from any tax revenue raised, or they want subsidies for developing new technology, if they're a green technology manufacturer. Plus, they want to pass on what they will claim is the unavoidable extra cost to the consumers, that is us. In fact, in the scare campaign currently being run by industry, Tony Shepherd, the chair of Transfield Services and Connect East, is quite explicit. There is no magic pudding. This probably comes as a surprise of you who believe in magic puddings, but there is none. One way or another, the cost of taxing carbon dioxide will be passed on to the consumer. And if we can't be made to pay for it all, he warns that if these costs are instead absorbed by industry, there will be job losses and it'll be ours and not his. So if the companies aren't actually paying any of the costs, then this apparent incentive to move away from polluting fossil fuels disappears, or it's certainly weakened. When you couple that with a compensation package where it appears the government's proposing paying some companies up to 94.5% of the cost of conversion or adaptation, or possibly even completely exempting industries such as steel from carbon costs, any notion that a carbon tax will have an impact on emissions or chasing technology is clearly nonsense. Saturday's Age newspaper, conveniently, so there's an article saying that at $20 a tonne, the price of carbon, once you pay out all the compensation, they went through all the companies and so claiming compensation and the compensation to us, there'd be about 10% of the revenue left over, which is about $1 billion. This is absolute chicken feed compared to the enormity of change that a switch to renewable energy and lower emissions would require. I mean, it's just meaningless. But pay for the advertising. Although we don't know the actual price the government will put on carbon, matching their weak 5% target cutting emissions by 2020, it's commonly suggested it'll be around $20 per tonne of carbon. Most commentators say that for any meaningful change from fossil fuel to renewables would require a price of at least $60 a tonne. And if there weren't the other measures from government, such as directed investment in R&D and renewables and so on, a price in excess of $100 a tonne is necessary. Okay, but for some companies, the tax will provide a real bonus. 20 companies recently signed a letter supporting the carbon tax. You sort of think, okay, what's going on here? One of them, General Electric, that tiny little company, has made big bets on a low-carbon economy by preparing for such a move as early as 2005, and they put sort of billions of dollars into research and development. And the firm's Australian director, Ben Waters, says it's about saving money, reducing emissions, and making money unashamedly. What's not to like about it? And this is before the government's promise of moving from a carbon tax, so if they've milked as much as they can, to an emission and paid off all the companies, to an emissions trading system, which is truly a license to print money for the polluters. Under Europe's emissions trading scheme, for example, and they say they've fixed it all up and that it doesn't do the things that it did before. Now, by 2012, power companies are expected to gain between $31 billion and $96 billion by charging consumers for the costs of holding carbon permits, which, in fact, they were given for free.
Mm-hmm.
And the scheme hasn't even reduced emissions by it to any significant extent. In Australia, earlier talk of an emissions trading system resulted in a barrage of demands from the, for free permits. And you can expect the same as we move from a carbon tax to emissions trading scheme in, how many years at the time it happens. For working class households, despite all the talk of compensation for a carbon tax, which will be both inadequate and temporary, despite any government spin on this matter, the reality is that across the board, prices will increase. As far as electricity and gas are concerned, there are already price rises in the pipeline as all the companies are faced with massive infrastructure upgrading, which they've avoided doing so far while they've been continuing to strip the companies of profit. And it's clear that companies, again, despite the compensation they receive, will charge more for the any supposed residual costs of a carbon tax. For workers, there's little possibility of doing anything to avoid the higher charges. Being told to look at cutting emissions by catching public transport becomes somewhat laughable prospect if you live somewhere where there is no public transport and no prospect of it for at least 3 to 5 years, as it seems to be the case in some new housing developments in Western Melbourne at the moment. Equally ridiculous are the Sydney Morning Herald suggestions, and I'll quote them, "You can turn off your second fridge or stop heating the pool all year round and you can ride a bike instead of swimming in your home pool." And they're, in all seriousness, this is in the national paper. And there are lots of other examples I haven't got time to go into now, but I'm sure people will know about them. Effectively, then, you have a tax on companies for which some workers will get a less than adequate compensation packages, and then all workers will have to face increased charges for a whole range of goods and services as companies charge extra for the impact of a carbon tax. And so, okay, the tax is going on a few companies at the top, but because it's electricity and gas and the like, that flows all the way down through the line. So every step of the way, each company is going to claim that carbon tax is costing them, and they'll pass it on to us. And in the area of energy supply, there'll be no compensation for the price rises already factored into the system for this massive infrastructure upgrading that I talked about. There's another fundamental aspect of a tax levied by governments that also points to why the carbon tax, like any other tax actually, is a hit on the working class. And Chris Harman in Zombie Capitalism explains this very clearly, and you can look it up at page 113, so check it out if you don't follow the entire argument here. But he writes, "The dependence of the state bureaucracy on capitalist exploitation is often concealed by the way in which it raises revenues, by taxation of incomes and expenditure, by government borrowing or printing money. All of these activities seem, on the surface, to be quite different from capitalist exploitation at the point of production. The state therefore seems like an independent entity which can raise the resources it needs by levying funds from any class of society. But this semblance of independence disappears when the state's activities are seen in the wider context. The monies available to the state for taxing aren't just, you know, dollars lying around in bank accounts or like. They're part of the total social surplus value, part of the total amount by which the value of workers' output exceeds the cost of reproducing their labour power. You know, what I was talking about before, the source of capitalism's profit. There is a constant conflict between different sections of capital, including the state, over their share of this surplus value. The state bureaucracy uses its overarching power, its special position, to establish laws to introduce taxes, you know, the carbon tax, and on occasion even using the armed forces to enforce their right. In response, other sections of capital will use their own special position. Industrial capital, its ability to postpone investment. Money capital, its ability to move overseas to fight back. And we can see many recent examples of that, especially in the earlier battle over the mining super profit tax, and now, of course, with the carbon tax. So tax is neither a neutral tool, nor is it a tool of a government independent of the capitalist process. It is, in fact, a part of the constant battle within the ruling class over access to the surplus value that we produce. That means that though the carbon tax is portrayed as targeting less than 1% of all Australian companies responsible for carbon pollution, in fact, it is the government claiming some of the surplus value workers have produced in those companies to redistribute to other firms to cover in part their development and transition costs. In imposing a carbon tax as well, the ALP is also playing its usual role of governing in the national interest. It is primarily about keeping Australian capitalism competitive in the world economy by saving the ruling class the cost of transition to the greener technology and subsidising the development of new industries ready to compete internationally. This is why you see the Greens and others complaining that Australia has missed the boat on solar energy and that the government has to fund development in this sector to catch up with the likes of Germany and the US. Of course, the vested interests in Australian capitalism are not about to give up their current subsidies or share of surplus value without a fight. You know, I'm talking about the coal companies and the like who get billions of dollars a year in subsidies to keep going. And we're witnessing a pretty savage scare campaign started by a resource industry still triumphal over its defeat of the mining super profit tax, not to mention the deposing of the then Prime Minister. The oil industry has been the first cab off the rank. Despite record profits and the spare $40 billion or so that BHP Billiton has to buy out Woodside, $48 billion to invest in its massive expansion, tripling of its Pilbara mines by 2020, we're talking about a very long time there, the resource moguls warned government that a carbon tax could break the camel's back on oil refinery investment in Australia, as well as drain funds from efficiency and carbon reduction. Well, guess what happened earlier this month? Shell announced that the shutdown of West Sydney Clyde Refinery, with plans to turn it into a storage facility for imported refined oil, and about 500 jobs will go. Of course, Shell has been planning this for some time, and it has nothing to do with the government's proposed carbon tax. They even admit that. But the company's timing and targeting of Western Sydney, particularly after, you know, the results of the New South Wales election and all of that, in the middle of the carbon tax debate, is pure backmail. The liquid natural gas suppliers, Shell, BHP, Billiton and the rest of them, are now demanding exemption from the carbon tax for that industry, despite the fact that most commentators acknowledge that the low, you know, the pitiful carbon price that the government's putting on will actually simply sort of, the way that the energy economy in Australia is operates, it will simply give an enormous boost to gas as the preferred energy source to coal. And Origin Energy, if you read in the paper the other day, has just done a $90 billion deal with China. So there's no shortage of future profits already locked into that industry. But they say, you know, we can't possibly survive a carbon tax. BlueScope Steel is now arguing that it can't afford to act to cut emissions, announcing a $55 million loss for the 6 months to December 2010. But let's look back just a very short while. Whatever happened to the $406.9 million profit they made to the 6 months to the end of December 2008? This is not a company going under. And if renewables are adopted, there is a guaranteed market for steel in the transition to a zero carbon economy, in the production of train rolling stock, wind turbines and so on. You know, and it goes on and on and on. You can look at any industry like that. So what about working class response to such daylight robbery? In the general community, there is still widespread support for measures to combat climate change. After all, none of us want to see the planet destroyed. At the same time, the government's proposal, a carbon tax, is deeply unpopular, with the polls, and this is as of the 18th of April, indicating 59% against carbon tax, with 34% for it. An essential research poll found 49% were opposed. That then fell to 33%, so there were sort of more people in favour of the tax, when people were asked their attitude if the money collected from the polluters was used to compensate lower middle income earners and small businesses. And a recent Australian Conservation Foundation poll actually shows that this opposition to a carbon tax, blamed by many on the scare campaigns, and I've given you examples of, you know, what they're running with, run by business and Tony Abbott, so it's not, you know, it's often blamed on those scare campaigns. It's actually more likely to be based on the clear understanding that the tax is an attack on workers, and rather than that people don't actually want to do something, which Clive Hamilton in the paper the other day so disgracefully wrote. The ACF poll result was that 70% of people agree that business lobby groups run scare campaigns on jobs and electricity prices to protect their members from paying the pollution they create. The union movement, however, has failed to harness any of the sentiment for action over climate change to turn it into a clear pro-working class push for polluter pays, new green jobs and the like, nor in any way as part of a strategy to rebuild unionism, to forge alliances with other forces. It's yet another example of the political and industrial decline of the Australian union movement that Tom Bramble outlines in his book, Trade Unionism in Australia. This lack of preparedness, lack of action, has meant that the unions have become hostage to the ruling class agenda. For the ruling class, the only deal on the table now is a price on carbon. And the union response is almost entirely focused on that. The only real demand coming out is compensation for low-income families today. And also, we should note the way that families is used in this debate over and over and over again to take away anything, any issue about class. This is sort of divert the whole argument away from understanding that this is a class issue. The peak union body, the ACTU, has come in firmly behind the government. The ACTU says climate change is one of the most pressing economic, social and environmental challenges we face, and Australians will be hit hard if we do not respond with urgent and decisive action to reduce carbon pollution, improve energy efficiency and support the transition to a low pollution economy. Right now is a crucial time to tell the government and the opposition that we support a price on carbon. That's it. President Giacchini at a recent climate change conference waved the union's white flag, saying, "The neoliberals have won the debate and we are going to see a restructure along emissions trading lines." And so to win workers to this neoliberal agenda, she announced that the ACTU is about to launch, and you'll see this after Easter, about to launch a Your Rights at Work type campaign to pull in the working class behind this attack on themselves. But also some of the most class-conscious left-wing union officials are backing a carbon tax. At the same session with Giacchini, Luke Vandermeulen from the Mining and Energy Division of the Construction Union said straight out, "We've got no argument with this, it's capitalism that's causing the problem. We have to challenge capitalism if we want to deal with the environment." He rightly pointed out that his members are focused on environmental challenges because they are at the heart of them, the power stations in the Latrobe Valley. and having more and being, you know, more democratic than most, he spoke about how his union doesn't believe in just handing down union policy to the members. They actually put it to a vote. So now he's actively campaigning amongst power station workers for a union position on environmental questions, a position that totally capitulates to the employer's agenda. And this is what the members are voting on. A price on carbon, tax or cap and trade scheme is inevitable. We will become irrelevant if we don't get involved. We recognise that a carbon price will drive energy prices up in real terms. Any carbon pricing system will generate enormous funds, $1 billion, where workers are negatively impacted as a result of putting a price on carbon. Their community must be compensated and not the companies. Now, I've got no argument with that last point, but the whole tenor of this has got nothing to do with having any sort of serious fight. And they, you know, they've even got this sort of fabulous glossy leaflet which says why a price on carbon is essential for our future. Opposition to the carbon tax from the right-wing AWU has only surfaced after the steelworks bosses threatened job losses if the government didn't exempt the steel industry from the carbon tax. The South Australian branch claimed that for the state's two steel towns, Whyalla and Port Pirie, it would be goodbye. They will be off the map. Total destruction of two cities. There was no opposition from the AWU because it was an attack on working class conditions. In fact, Paul Howe says they support a carbon tax. And in fact, their response actually indicated that they're not even prepared to defend their own members' jobs from the steel bosses' threats. Rather, that they were there to defend the interests of one of Australia's most polluting industries. Because, as I said, they didn't say anything until after the steel bosses threatened. And finally, it will, as it already has done, disorient the left. It has drawn those who say they are opposed to a carbon tax, though not on a clear caste basis like I've argued, into support for the pro-carbon tax campaign. Socialist Alliance, who claim the carbon tax, claim they oppose the carbon tax, base most of their actual argument, and it's a leaflet here, on the fact that the tax will do little, if anything, to promote renewables or move to a zero emissions economy. In this leaflet, almost no mention is made of it being an attack on the working class. There is almost no argument for any working class demands, for trade union action to make the polluters pay. Instead, there are abstract demands for taking into public hands those companies who refuse to act on cutting emissions and a just transition for workers into green jobs. You know, we're nothing behind it. These are totally meaningless demands. And more disgraceful is the commentary from one of their leading climate activists, Ben Cortese, who regularly has a go at me, writing on his blog about the March 12 demonstration in Melbourne. I was hugely impressed by the rally, for which I've heard estimates of between 5 and 10,000 people. Pretty good for a rally organised with 1 week's notice. This kind of positive sentiment for climate action is something we can draw hope from. Socialist Alliance, and then he goes on, this is a thing where people quite clearly said we're for a carbon tax. Socialist Alliance had a banner which might have been taken as a stand against the government's carbon price legislation, but you couldn't read that part of it at all. And then he puts in brackets, which may have been a good thing. As I said, this is a rally where most speakers called for a tax, said nothing about the fact that the tax would do nothing for the climate and was a direct slug on workers. So, to sum up, capitalism is a system that has survived through massive changes in the way the productive processes operate. In fact, it must do, as it both depletes the natural resources of the world and is driven to extract ever more profit to survive. While it is clearly causing near catastrophic environmental destruction, demands and campaigns that seek merely to change the technology without changing the fundamental basis of capitalism are destined to extend the destructive reach of capitalism rather than end it. The carbon tax is the worst of all worlds. It will do nothing to reduce carbon pollution. It's a mechanism whereby the working class will be made to pay, not only for continuing pollution, but also for keeping Australian capitalism competitive on a world scale by subsidising any cost of technological change for industry. What's more, by supporting a carbon tax, it will draw unions and the left into a disastrous class collaborationist scheme that will further discredit and weaken unionism and left alternatives. Instead, the revolutions in the Middle East, the history of class struggle in Australia, where unions have taken up environmental questions in a progressive way, the union bans on uranium, the green bans, show what's possible if we both understand how capitalism works and what we need to do to overthrow it. That's the direction we should be heading, and not some capitulation to ruling class solutions.